If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
A very good evening and thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for coming to POV. Thank you, Lisa.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Professor Lisa Davis is a professor of law and senior associate dean of the clinical program at CUNY Law School. And she's also serves as a special advisor on gender and other discriminatory crimes to the International Court, Criminal Court. And so we obviously are having this conversation because we started a series a few weeks ago on reimagining justice when we are considering the submissions on the treaty of criminalizing apartheid and other crimes. And you've obviously been doing a lot of work in that respect. I just want us to begin with the definitions, just so that everybody's on the same page and how, why it's so important to be clear on the definitions of crime of apartheid. Let's just start there.
Well, sure. Well, you know, first I should probably start by saying that I've taken a little bit of a step back in my role as the special advisor on gender and other discriminatory crimes to the International Criminal Court.
Got you.
Because of the sanctions placed against the court by the Trump administration.
Yes.
But I am suing the Trump administration for violating my constitutional rights for administering those sanctions. So hopefully, that will...
Things will change.
Things will change. Now, to your question about the definition of the crime of apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a different way that criminal law defines crimes as opposed to how human rights law defines human rights violations.
That's it. Okay.
And apartheid, defined under the CERD convention, which is the convention to end, to eliminate all forms of racial discrimination, defines it as a human rights violation. And it defines it, really, it's implied as a social construct. It really takes a broad approach to how it looks at racial discrimination.
Mm.
And that's really important because race is a social construct, and we do want to cast a broad net so that we are recognizing victims when they're discriminated against, and especially when that discrimination takes the form of apartheid.
Mm.
Under criminal law, we don't have any jurisprudence. So we really don't know how apartheid is defined as a crime or how it's applied in different contexts. What we do have is the definition of apartheid, if first in the Apartheid Convention, which was codified in 1974. And then we have apartheid as a crime codified in the Rome Statute that governs the International Criminal Court. And that was codified in 2003. So if we look at the definition in both these contexts, you start to have to dig into the terms and what they mean.
Mm.
And one of the problems with criminal law is that it doesn't evolve as fast as human rights law.
Yeah. Nor does it necessarily borrow from human rights law.
That's right. We hold a higher standard to criminal law because it has that teeth, because it can put people in jail. So we take a very strict construction to criminal law, and we also want to protect defendants' rights.
Yeah.
So when you look at the definition of apartheid and you start digging into it, you notice that some of the terms that it uses, like, for example, it uses the term racial groups. So what apartheid says under the Rome Statute, just to summarize it, it says it's basically conduct that is committed in the context of an institutional regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another racial group or groups.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to look at what that means. What does racial group mean? Because that's how we're going to define victims.
Yeah.
And when you look at the definition of apartheid under the Rome Statute, it borrowed the definition, made some changes, but it borrowed it from the Apartheid Convention, which took its understanding of racial groups from the Genocide Convention.
Gotcha.
Which was formed back in 1952. And that made sense because when the Apartheid Convention was being formed, there was a lot of analogies and a lot of equating apartheid with genocide.
Mm.
And there were a lot of similarities between apartheid policies and those policies that led to the genocide in World War II.
Yeah.
But the problem is that the way we understood groups or race back in the 40s and 50s and 60s is really different than how we understand it today. Mm-hmm. And back then, there was this idea that race was really based on biology and that or hereditary characteristics. And that turned into a requirement for courts to have to see evidence of biology or hereditary characteristic for a victim to be included in genocide genocide charges. And so courts were really stuck with this. Now, they've mostly moved away from it. They really do look at what did the perpetrator intend, because after all, isn't that what's important? Mm-hmm. If the perpetrator intended to discriminate against you, intended to further acts of apartheid, you know, then that's what we care about. But they always still required some kind of evidence of biological hereditary characteristics, because they probably felt beholden to how drafters intended these terms when these statutes were made 40, 50 years ago.
So if I can just bring it back home to South Africa and just to connect the dots, what you're saying is that in some of these cases that we are confronted with right now domestically, you would have to fulfill those requirements if, and I want to think of cases now that are obvious, it'll come to me, where, for instance, if the victim was white, but clearly was someone who was fighting apartheid themselves, it would be harder to find against the perpetrators. Because of biology. Is that what we say?
Yes, if the victim was white.
Correct.
Well, in domestic law, it really depends on what the court is relying on for understanding the crime of apartheid. Under international law, so the International Criminal Court, for example, it would have a hard time being able to bring those charges.
That's what I'm saying.
Charges.
So for some people who fought apartheid in this country who were white, if they had to take this to the International Criminal Court, they would struggle to get the kind of justice that we're looking for under the current laws, because genetically they wouldn't fit the code.
That's correct.
Okay. Continue.
This is the problem with international criminal law, is that oftentimes when we're creating new statutes or new treaties, it's just easier to cut and paste definitions from old treaties into new treaties. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, if you look at the definition of genocide, it hasn't changed much since it was being drafted in the 40s and finally came into codification through the Genocide Convention. Mm-hmm. It just seems to be cut and pasted as it goes along. And we don't want to do that. We want law to reflect modern understandings of how we understand victims and how we understand crimes.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, the reason I was bringing up that example, we had many, many, many people who suffered under apartheid, who were white, who were themselves, you know, fighting the same system. So it's important for us to understand why the social construct is important, and why the clear definition of just a racial group is not sufficient. And that's why part of this work is about maybe clarifying what kind of language goes into codifying apartheid as a crime.
Sure. And it doesn't just affect white victims. It affects all victims.
Yes.
Because all victims would have to prove their hereditary characteristics as belonging to a group. And that becomes, you know, that's just based on debunked scientific beliefs that we no longer believe. It's outdated. And it's really what perpetrators did. Do we want to be like the perpetrators? That's what the Nazis and the Afrikaners did, right? They used these hereditary characteristics, tracing lineage, looking at ancestry, looking at, you know, what they could observe physically to determine what your race is and whether or not, you know, where you fell into the oppression hierarchy.
So what's contained in the current drafts that we're working on to submit for, let's say, for South Africa, for instance, their submissions? What are the things that we should be looking out for?
Well, there's a new draft Crimes Against Humanity treaty that's making its way through the international community, and it's about to be discussed next spring with states. Mm-hmm. And they've adopted a definition of apartheid that was a cut and paste from the Rome Statute that was largely a cut and paste from the Apartheid Convention. Mm. So this is an opportunity to be able to revisit that language and bring a modernized understanding of apartheid so that we don't leave out victims. Mm-hmm. And this is especially important in the international scene because we have contexts of apartheid happening right now. Mm. For example, Palestine. Mm. It clearly would meet the standard of apartheid in terms of that context. And Palestinians should have their experiences recognized by the crimes that best fit the conditions of oppression that they're in. Mm-hmm. And so if we don't change this, if we don't modernize this definition of apartheid as a crime, then we're going to perpetuate the invisibility of Palestinians and other victims of apartheid conditions.
With the current definition, how does it discriminate against the Palestinians, for instance?
Well, because this idea of racial group has been used to create an excuse to say that Palestinians aren't a racial group, therefore they can't be victims of apartheid. Now, this is a little different from genocide, where genocide actually protects four different groups, racial, ethnic, national, and religious. And when you look at the International Court of Justice, they have said there's a duty for Israel to protect against genocide in Palestine, that we see acts that may amount to genocide happening there. But what the court did, because they needed probably to avoid being able to, you know, this problem of calling Palestinians a racial group, is they said, well, Palestinians fall into all four groups protected under the Genocide Convention. And we see courts do this. It's called the ensemble approach, where you say, well, they kind of fall into all four, so we're not going to name them as a explicit group of any of the four, but it's sufficient to say that they're protected from genocide. That doesn't work under apartheid because you only have one protected group, which is racial groups.
And if you had to be quite strict about it, they are not classified as a racial group. And therefore, currently, that wouldn't serve, you know, to justify them as a racial group. And therefore, you couldn't criminalize the perpetrator in this case.
Exactly. Under international criminal law, that's the question. Mm. Under human rights law, there is no question. Mm. They absolutely fall into the context of being subjected to apartheid. And in fact, human rights experts have found that numerous times. Mm. But human rights law doesn't have the teeth that criminal law has. Mm. And it's important to find apartheid in its criminal context and to name it as apartheid.
So what should we be looking for when we review and ourselves, when we look at this draft treaty and the language that's currently there so that we can, in a way, sort of cover our bases and update the language?
Well, when you look at the crime of persecution, so that's the third major crime that covers discriminatory crimes, right? You have genocide, apartheid, and persecution. And persecution's been around since World War II and a long time as well. Persecution doesn't require any sort of biological test or hereditary characteristics. It really just bases it on the perception of the perpetrator. So if the perpetrator intended to discriminate against that victim, then that's sufficient. And that is exactly what it should be. And we should be looking at apartheid the same way. And to do that, one way would be adding two little words to the definition of apartheid. Based on. Based on race instead of racial group. And that would change the entire meaning legally.
Legally, if you use the words based on, prefix racial group with based on, it would mean that you mean based on the interpretation of the perpetrator.
Yes, exactly. Based on the perceptions of the perpetrator, which really is sufficient. This additional evidence of, you know, biological characteristics, it's just irrelevant and not necessary. And it's really, you know, being used as an excuse to exclude groups from recognition, such as Palestinians.
Is that the only two words that would sort of capture what is necessary to criminalize things like what is happening with what we're seeing in parts of the world like Palestine?
Well, I mean, there's lots of ways you could redefine or change the definition of apartheid to be more of a contemporary understanding. Mm-hmm. But these two words would be probably the most minimal change that you could do so that you're not changing too much, mm-hmm. because we do want to preserve the rest of the language, mm-hmm. you know, and we want to preserve the historical legacy of apartheid. It's its context in a colonialist settler oppression and be able to, you know, retain its gravity.
Mm. Once we've gotten past the language, I just want us to fully grasp what it would mean for local groups, for instance, in different states, and how one would go about implementing what it's meant to do. So let's say it will be after April, I think, next year, where everybody will submit. South Africa, I think, would have to submit sometime next year. And then past that point, what has to happen? It has to be ratified, does it not?
Yes, that's true. So states have until April 30th of 2026 to make submissions on what they think about the draft Crimes Against Humanity Treaty. And then it's going to go to a committee of states to discuss. So this is an opportunity to weigh in and to be able to discuss this issue with the definition of apartheid. You know, look, I was at the Peterson Museum in Soweto, mm-hmm. And walking through that museum and learning about the student protests, mm-hmm. and the oppression that was happening in South Africa, and the children who died, and you just see the correlations between apartheid in South Africa and apartheid in Palestine. Mm. You see it. Mm. And it's clear that we need to be able to gain redress for apartheid where it happens in the world, not just in Palestine, but in future instances as well. And it's exactly why the South African government, in part, ratified the Apartheid Convention just last year, or I think this year, actually. Mm. You know, part of that is because South Africa has been taking the lead on addressing racial discrimination and other discriminatory crimes in the world. Mm. And South Africa's voice is incredibly important to this movement and to finding redress for discriminatory crimes like apartheid.
How would, you know, past that point where perhaps it does go ahead and it's ratified, how does that then work with what we have domestically? Would we need the state for individual cases to go through? How would it work?
Well, the Crimes Against Humanity draft treaty doesn't come with a treaty body. That's not, at least in the current draft. So it really would be a treaty where states would ratify it and then have a commitment to pass it into domestic legislation. And the point is really to help codify these crimes domestically so that if these crimes happened, there's a way to prosecute them that gives them the holistic breadth of what they are, real institutional memory for what happened, and to really accurately capture these crimes. So we've learned this lesson in places like Colombia and Ukraine that don't have crimes against humanity in their domestic legislation, and they've had to find some creative workarounds to find the right charges domestically to be able to address crimes that have happened in their conflicts.
And in the event that the states don't do that, can an individual family or a case go over and above the state and go straight to the International Criminal Court?
Well, the International Criminal Court can bring its own cases, or states can refer cases to the International Criminal Court. But updating and modernizing the definition of the crime of apartheid in the Crimes Against Humanity Treaty would help the International Criminal Court be able to bring future apartheid charges, because the court, remember, is stuck with the 25-year-old language from the Rome Statute that has apartheid defined. But the Rome Statute also has another article, Article 21. Mm. That says the court needs to interpret the statute within line with modern understandings of international law. Mm. So we need something to show that this is a modern understanding of apartheid, that race is a social construct, that we're basing it on perpetrators' intent, and that we're not going to forget places like Palestine.
Mm. And in the event that all of this goes through and it's done, what this means is that there are people or peoples that can be, even if it's just a warrant of arrest, upon the suspicion that maybe this person is a perpetrator, before we even get to the case itself being heard in court.
Well, world treaties carry the weight of the world's opinion.
Yeah.
And so when you update or modernize a definition, or when you don't, let's say we keep the old language, mm-hmm. we're reinforcing an outdated understanding of who a victim of apartheid can be. Mm-hmm. We're reaffirming that in the world's community. So it's really, really important to update these treaties and to make sure that the language in there reflects how we see the world today and how we understand crimes today. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we reinforce outdated notions mm-hmm. and we keep invisibilizing victims that will never then have the hope for accountability.
So I guess what I'm getting at, Professor Davis, is for those who are listening, they're thinking, with the current definitions, how come they haven't worked, even the limited definitions?
I mean, that is a good question. Ooh, and a big question. I think part of the problem with Palestine, at least, has been political will. Mm. Right? We have no jurisprudence on apartheid. We have no accountability for apartheid cases. Mm. How can that be? Mm. Why is that? You know, and part of changing political will starts by acknowledging that the crimes you are codifying cover every one of its victims, mm-hmm. that it doesn't just cover a few. It doesn't require these unnecessary high bars of evidence that are based on outdated notions, and that we believe in redress for victims mm-hmm. and we believe in accountability for victims. And modernizing the definition of apartheid in the new draft treaty that's making its way through the international community would do this. It would send that message. Mm-hmm. And I think it would help bolster movements to bring redress and accountability for such crimes.
Where in the case of South Africa, it would be much simpler. How come we haven't seen any change there?
Well, that is a good question. I think that it's a good topic for us to have an experts workshop on next time we come to town.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's very important. And I think we keep, discussing this so that people understand why this is so important, that we lobby for people, first of all, to also be very interested. But you spoke about political will. How important is the political will with all the treaties that we have in place to shift the needle in what is possible with the laws that we have and those we want to update?
Well, I think there's a lot of support for finding redress for discriminatory crimes, including in Palestine, and a lot of resistance to it. You know, states are sometimes resistant to laws that regulate their behaviors and what they have to do. And and when crimes are universally wrong, they have to be upheld as wrong. Mm. And South Africa plays an important role in leading this issue and showing the world that we can do better. And so, you know, this is why we held an experts meeting here in Johannesburg, was to discuss this issue, was to talk to activists from Afghanistan, Palestine, South African women rights activists, scholars, government officials, members of Chapter 9 commissions. Mm-hmm. It was a really robust discussion. Mm-hmm. You were there. And it was great to be able to see that everyone agrees mm-hmm. that we need to be looking at apartheid from a modern sense that really captures all of its victims. That we had consensus on.
Is that the sense? I mean, I think South Africa, as you said, there is a sense that everybody agrees that we need to modernize this language. Is that the sense, internationally? Is the sense that this is necessary?
Well, I think that most states don't know about this outdated language. Look, it's not common knowledge. Mm. I think very few people know. Mm. There were a couple of us that did the work of digging into it to say, What's been some of the barriers? What are the problems? Why can't we get redress in Palestine, for example? And so digging into the law and looking at the language and realizing that there are these barriers, we've been trying to have those conversations, especially with people who have experience with the issue, which is why we came to South Africa first. Because it's really important that people who have experienced an issue lead the movement for that issue and be able to take on that issue. And, you know, working with organizations like MADRE, which is an international feminist organization that's based in New York, it provides incredible support for Palestinian organizations and other grassroots groups around the world. This was a really important issue for MADRE as well, and why they wanted to fund this workshop to be able to have dialogue, not just present like a wall of voices, but to actually dig in deep to the issues and figure out what's the answer. Should we change the definition? And if we should, what should that look like? And how do we move forward? And it felt very productive having that meeting.
In fact, I was going to ask you, you know, MADRE, in the work that you do, and why it was so important for you to mobilize, as you said, scholars and the like, to get this thing done, and in a way done properly and looked at thoroughly. Why is South Africa central to this kind of submission?
Well, I think it's, you know, what I was saying before, that you have to talk to groups who have experienced the issue because they have the expertise. They have the history and the knowledge and the experience about what these crimes look like, how they're experienced, and what the solutions are to addressing them. You know, people like me who are international criminal law nerds, we can dig into language and tell you about the history of language and what legal language works, but that's half the formula. The other half of the formula is really understanding experiences and conditions. And it's been such a privilege to have this opportunity to build trust and collaborations with South African organizations on this issue.
Well, Professor Davis, thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time. And I mean, I hope it was worth it coming all the way to do this work. And obviously, we'll see, you know, hopefully the outcome of the work that you've put in. But really appreciate you coming through, and all the best to you, your colleagues at MADRE as well, and CUNY University as well.
Well, thanks again for having me.
Thank you. And we'll leave it at that. I'll be back with more after this.
If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.